But we're going to, and we in fact are joined on Skype by Frank Bowman. Frank Bowman's professor of law at the University of Missouri. He's a visiting scholar at Georgetown Law School, where he teaches a seminar on impeachment. And he is the author of a very recent book called High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. Frank Bowman, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you back to this radio program, these radio broadcasts concerning the impeachment.
Mitch, it's a pleasure to talk to you again, as always.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this because there's so many questions to ask you. But first, Frank, I got kind of excited during the oral arguments. I'm listening to Zoe Lofgren, a House floor manager for the Democrats, and she suddenly cites your work during the oral. Were you in the chamber when that happened? I know you were at the Senate sometime that day.
You know, people have said that happened, but I don't even know what day it happened. So when was it?
It was someday. I don't know, Frank. All the days are being mixed up now. Did you at least know you were?
I was definitely not in the chamber when that happened, but I'm gratified that some people have thought the work worthwhile.
Is that the first time you've been cited? I mean, the impeachment's kind of, you're sort of the impeachment guy. Is that the first time your name's ever been brought up in an impeachment trial? Or in even an impeachment
trial? Certainly, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the House report in this case is kind enough to refer to the book quite a lot. And interestingly enough, the president's brief in this case actually cites something I wrote 20 years ago. So, it's out there.
Good. Well, I'll just tell you, I was excited when I heard her bring up your work. Frank Bowman, what are your thoughts about this Senate impeachment trial?
I have lots of them.
Is there one important one, though, that stands out for you?
I think that, you know, the thing that is, of course, most notable at the moment is that we are barreling towards what, let's face it, is going to be an inevitable acquittal. And doing so despite the fact that there's not even an honest effort to make a full record on the charges against the president, and I think that is in fact sadder than the fact that he will be acquitted. I mean, let's face it here, despite the hopeful expectations or wishes of people who disapprove of Mr. Trump, there was never anything more than the tiniest chance that he would actually be convicted. The basic reason why is that the Constitution, of course, requires 2/3 of the Senate. That means 67 votes, and that means 20 Republican senators. And, you know, opponents of Mr. Trump can wish it were otherwise, but that was always going to be pretty much an insuperable barrier to actual conviction. But what makes this case different than anything that's gone before is the really marked unwillingness, the stubborn unwillingness of the president's party even to allow the development of a full record. And that's very disheartening.
Is this different than what we saw in 1999 with the Senate trial for Bill Clinton?
Oh, sure. First of all, of course, the issues were dramatically different.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever one thinks of Bill Clinton, the thing he was charged with was a very discreet kind of wrong. He had adulterous sexual activity with a young woman, and then he lied about it, and then arguably tried to cover up the lie. Very small, very discreet, and what's more, fully, exhaustively investigated before it ever made it to the House. And that, of course, is one of the things that more or less, you know, gives the lie to some of the arguments that have been made by the president's counsel today and throughout this process. By the time the Clinton matter made it to the House, the independent counsel, Ken Starr, had conducted months-long investigation just of the Lewinsky matter, not to speak of other things he'd been unsuccessfully investigating the Clintons for. And when his investigation culminated, he actually bound the results into a 400-page plus report with multiple thousands of pages of supporting documents and delivered it all in a van to the House of Representatives. And frankly, from that moment forward, there was very little, if any, additional material evidence discovered. So when it got over, and that, of course, is the, this is, of course, the basic error, flaw of the whole notion that Mitch McConnell has been pitching for the whole Senate proceeding, that somehow or other we must go by exactly the same set of procedures that was used in Bill Clinton, because that's somehow or other written into stone or is, you know, a constitutional great writ. No, it isn't. I mean, the Clinton process, as narrow and attenuated as it was, with no live witnesses and only three witnesses deposed, was that way because the record was absolutely complete, really, by the time the matter got to the House in the first place, and it was certainly essentially complete by the time the House was done. And of course, as we all know by this point, that is not true here, and it's not true in two respects. First, prior to the House taking up the question of the Ukraine affair, there was no external investigation at all. Bob Mueller, of course, investigated other things, but he was out of business before the Ukraine matter broke. And actually, as some of your listeners may remember, shortly after the infamous phone call, there was actually a referral from somebody over in some other agency to the Justice Department about the possible impropriety of what Mr. Trump had said, and a DOJ essentially declined to investigate further.
Yeah.
So Department of Justice didn't do anything with this.
Yeah, that's right. It went to, I mean, I think even to William Barr.
It actually went to DOJ, and they declined it.
Yeah.
So no investigation by outside the House. The House had to do the investigation on its own, which is something really that's never happened before in American history. And therefore, the House had to develop such
records. What had never happened before, Frank? The House doing this?
The House essentially developing the whole case on its own. I mean, I suppose arguably you could make the case that happened in the Andrew Johnson affair to some extent. But as I think was mentioned on the floor today, the Andrew Johnson case was a very peculiar business. I won't go into all the details. But impeachment occurred very, very quickly after the precipitating event, which was Johnson fired the Secretary of War in violation of the Tenure of Office Act. He did that on February the 21st of 1868. He was impeached 3 days later by the House, who didn't even bother to actually write articles of impeachment.
Yeah, didn't they just impeach him and then have to go back and write the articles?
Yeah, they went back and wrote the articles later. And when the matter got to the Senate, there were roughly 40 witnesses that appeared in the Senate.
40 witnesses?
More than 30 of which, I think maybe as many as 37 of them, had not appeared in the House. So there's a couple things we can see here. On the one hand, the claim that it's somehow or other improper to have new witnesses in the Senate that didn't appear in the House is, you know, first of all, there's nothing in the Constitution that suggests that at all. In any case, there are dramatically different precedents, particularly in the Johnson impeachment. Anyway, bottom line is this is quite different than both Clinton and Johnson. The Clinton rules were created because the record was complete by the time it came out of the House. There really weren't any arguments about the facts. Everybody knew what Clinton had done. The whole argument was just, was it something for which he should be removed? And of course, in this case, while the facts presented by the House are very strong, nonetheless, a principal claim by the president is you haven't proved it because you can't bring in anybody who actually heard me say, you know, go commit the crime. That being the case, it makes rather good sense to me that if there are people who might have done that, and apparently John Bolton heard precisely that, we should bring him in.
I want to talk more about John Bolton and his situation with you, Frank Bowman. So on one hand, if the Senate decides not to have witnesses, that's its own tragedy, but then that's what it is. And they'll probably go also by Friday, if not Saturday at the latest, vote on conviction, whether or not to convict or acquit President Donald Trump. But let's say they do move forward to have witnesses, having witnesses, including John Bolton. Donald Trump has already indicated he would do everything he can to block John Bolton's testimony to the Senate impeachment trial. Now, just like, and we've talked about this before, the House has the sole power to conduct impeachment. The Senate has the sole power to conduct the trial. What happens if Donald Trump stops and tries to stop John Bolton? Does this eventually have to go to the courts?
I don't think so. There are two possible avenues that he could embrace. One of them, and I think really the only one that has any validity, is he could raise some objection in the Senate itself to Mr. Bolton testifying. He could, for example, try to assert executive privilege. He could try to claim, as apparently he is now doing, that somehow or other all the things that Bolton would talk about, or many of them, are classified, and somehow or other that prevents him from testifying in the Senate. Two things to be said about this. The first question is whether either of those claims have any legal merit. I think the answer is no. Executive privilege is a doctrine, yes, but it is not an absolute doctrine. It is limited only to communications with the president's personal advisors. And it, in every case, it yields to a sufficient showing of need. And in this particular case, one can hardly imagine a greater showing of need. The president says, you can't prove the case against me because you haven't brought in anybody who can say that I ordered the crime. Well, we need to hear the person to whom you said that. So an absolutely incredibly powerful showing of need. In fact, it would certainly, I think, be sufficient even if this were an ordinary criminal case. In the case of a president for an impeachment, they require that, I mean, the showing of need is even greater, right? I mean, it goes to the essence of the matter. The notion raised that somehow or other this is classified material and therefore the Senate can't hear it is also completely unsupportable. If a president could block testimony in an impeachment trial where he was essentially being accused of compromising American national security by his behavior, then that would mean the president would become immune to impeachment for the very gravest kinds of wrongs, the kinds where, in fact, his behavior is putting national security at risk. He had simply insulated himself by declaring, oh, this is classified. And there's no warrant for that. I think on the merits, neither of those claims would stand up. But then the question is, okay, who gets to decide? My view is that the Senate decides. Initially, perhaps, if this were raised as a question of admissibility, the chair might decide in the first instance. Or he might just instantly defer to a majority of the senators. Whether he made the initial ruling or not, ultimately a majority of senators would decide. Who knows what they would say? But I do think it's, if in fact they authorize a subpoena to Bolton, I think it's fairly unlikely they would then say, oh, well, now you're over here, sorry, executive privilege. We can't hear what you said or what you want to say because we just acknowledge that the executive privilege is valid. That seems somewhat unlikely.
So are you saying, let me ask you this, I just want to be very clear about this. Are you saying that executive privilege, if the Senate in this impeachment trial, and again, the Senate has sole power to conduct this trial, if the Senate were to subpoena John Bolton to testify, regardless of what the president tries to do, it really has no standing?
Right.
He couldn't stop it?
The president has no ability to prevent a witness on a basis of executive privilege or claims of national security or claims that things are classified. He has no ability to prevent the Senate of the United States from hearing that witness. This is a core function of Congress, which is to check abuses of power by the president, to make sure that we don't have someone in office who is essentially willing to sacrifice America's national security and his own personal interests. That's the essence of the impeachment power. To say that the Senate is crippled from, is prevented from exercising that core constitutional function by the exertion or assertion of dubious privileges is just constitutional nonsense. Now, all that being said, you can talk all day long about, you know, what I think or anybody else thinks about the validity of such a claim. This, after all, is an impeachment trial in which the will of a majority of the senators rules. If 51 senators say, okay, executive privilege, we won't listen to Bolton, that would be the end of the matter. And which implies correctly that there's no appeal from that. Neither the president, nor for that matter the House managers, could go running off to the Supreme Court and say, well, we don't think executive privilege applies in such a case. I mean, I suppose they could try, but I'm reasonably confident that no court would hear it, that they would conclude that this is a non-justiciable political question and simply not entertain an appeal from any decision of the Senate. Now, the other thing that Trump could do is, rather than actually litigate this in the Senate, I think he knows he'd lose if the subpoena were actually issued. So what I suspect he'd do is instead try to file some sort of a collateral lawsuit trying to enjoin Bolton from testifying or something. But there too, I mean, that I think that has even less validity. I think it's deeply unlikely that any district court in the United States is going to somehow or other try to enjoin, either order the recipient of a subpoena from the Senate in an impeachment trial not to appear, or try to order the Senate not to enforce its subpoena. I just can't imagine a judge doing that. I think, again, they'd simply declare it a non-justiciable political question. And kick it right back over to the Senate. Now, that being said, and this is something the Republicans keep talking about, there would certainly be an effort by the president to drag things out. I suspect he would lose fairly quickly in the district court, either on the merits or because the court declares it non-justiciable or both. Trump would then try to appeal it, probably to the Court of Appeals. And even if even if that's dismissed, then Trump would try to appeal to the Supreme Court. And certainly that doesn't mean that even if he did, that doesn't mean the Senate trial has to stop, because the Senate can simply ignore whatever is going on over in the court. And unless a court were actually willing to order, and I can't imagine they would, John Bolton not to comply with a Senate subpoena, then Bolton is faced with a subpoena that remains valid and, you know, in effect, and he said he'd comply with it, so I think he testifies.
You're listening to the post-show of KPFA's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. I'm Mitch Jezrich in the studios of KPFA, and joining us on Skype is Frank Bowman, professor of law at the University of Missouri, visiting scholar at Georgetown Law School, author of the book High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. I'm going to give the phone number out here in 1 second for your listener, for listener comments and questions, but first, I just want to remind folks that the reason we're public broadcasting, the reason we are able to do this broadcast, is because of the generosity from listeners, and we are trying to raise the money that will allow us to continue to do this coverage as this Senate trial continues onwards. And I think we have some very important historic days. I found today actually quite interesting, a little easier to digest, Frank, than 24 hours straight from one side or the other. But again, we're going to have the vote concerning witnesses and additional evidence on Friday. If it doesn't pass, then if they don't allow for witnesses and evidence, then the trial could be over by the end of this week with a vote whether or not to convict or acquit President Donald Trump. They do have witnesses. This could, you know, open up a new avenue, and who knows where things could go after that. So for us to be able to do that, we need your support. The phone number to make a contribution, a financial contribution, is 1-800-439-4. 5732. I'm only going to give this number one more time and then only right when we're done with the program. So, again, very limited here, but we got to make it count when we do give out this number. 1-800-439-5732. And, of course, you could pledge online at kpfa.org. Now, not to confuse numbers here, because I'm about to give you a different number in which you can get your comment and question. And we have this great opportunity to have our questions to Frank Bowman, who teaches a seminar on impeachment at Georgetown Law School. The phone number to get your question or comment in is 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. Frank Bowman, I want to talk about basically what is the title of your book, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, because that was a big issue today, and especially concerning what we have been hearing from Alan Dershowitz for the defense for Donald Trump. And he is making this argument about high crimes and misdemeanors and abuse of power. And he's basically saying that abuse of power is not a part or under the umbrella of what high crimes and misdemeanors are, because abuse of power, it's hard to know even what that means. It's nebulous. And in fact, he even connects it and equates abuse of power, which is Article 1 of the Constitution, Article 1 of the impeachment articles, abuse of power to this term maladministration, which during the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was purposefully taken out as a reason for impeaching a president. So first, a couple things there to talk about, but let's talk about maladministration. What does that mean? Is maladministration the same as abuse of power?
No. This gets very complicated, and the problem with Alan is that, first of all, I think it's not clear that his understanding of all of this is particularly good. And to the extent he does understand it, he's willfully distorting both the history and the meaning of the Constitution. But let me see if I can make this as simple as I can without boring your listeners too much.
Well, let me say this. When I think of maladministration, I just think of the words themselves, right? Mal basically meaning bad, right? So you're bad at your job. Is that the correct way of understanding maladministration?
Well, the problem is that both high crimes and misdemeanors, which is this phrase which made it into our Constitution, and the word maladministration have been associated with impeachments for a really long time, going back into the period before 1787 in American practice and also 400 years of British history. Lots of people were impeached for maladministration in British practice. It was also a word that's sometimes used in the American states before the Constitution was adopted in 1787. But here's the important point. When, at the end of the Constitutional Convention in September of 1787, the framers had decided that they were going to define impeachable offenses. They didn't have to do that because, in fact, Parliament never had. Exactly. And so they needed a phrase. They needed some words. And they tried various formulas. And by September, they had just limited it to treason and bribery. And a number of the delegates, particularly George Mason, said, wait, that's way, 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 way too narrow. Treason and bribery, no, that's certainly not sufficient. And one of the reasons, and here's the key point, and this is why Alan is just so, so, so wrong. There's lots of reasons, but here's an easy illustration. George Mason gets up and says, treason and bribery, way too limited. Was an illustration of why treason and bribery is so limited. He says, in effect, Mason says this and refers this. He says, over in England right now, they're impeaching in Parliament a fellow named Warren Hastings, who's the Governor General of Bengal. What are they impeaching him for? Well, the articles of impeachment against Hastings call what he'd done high crimes and misdemeanors. What was the nature of what he'd done? All of what he'd done was abuses of power. Many, many articles charging him with abusing his power as the Governor General of Bengal. The guy who was prosecuting was Edmund Burke. Some of your listeners may know of him as a very famous parliamentarian and author, a famous conservative. And Burke, in the course of talking about the charges against Hastings, explicitly says to the Parliament, the things he's being charged with are not crimes in any ordinary sense. They are instead charged crimes against normal notions of morality, proper conduct of the government, and so forth and so on. In effect, he says we're impeaching this guy not because he's committed any crime, because he's abusing his power. And over here in the United States, George Mason is saying, we need a phrase that includes the kind of things for which, kinds of abuses of power for which Hastings is being impeached in England. His first suggestion is maladministration. He says, let's add maladministration. Madison says, well, I think that's too broad. In effect, he says, we don't want to be impeaching people merely for being bad at their jobs, merely for being a not very good president. We don't want to therefore give the Senate the opportunity to remove presidents merely because they disagree with them a little bit or because the president isn't terribly good at their jobs. And so then Mason comes back and says, okay, you don't like maladministration. Let's use this old term that the British Parliament's been using to describe impeachable offenses for 400 years, high crimes and misdemeanors. Everybody looks around the room. They say, fine, great, that's what we'll do. Now, what does high crimes and misdemeanors mean? Well, I mean, it's certainly right to say that it doesn't have any easily definable specific definition. But one thing we know without any doubt at all is that high crimes and misdemeanors includes abuses of power. No question whatsoever. Not only did the framers undoubtedly believe that to be true, the British Parliament had been using it in that way for centuries, and since the American framing, we have impeached people for non-criminal abuses of power. One of the articles against Nixon was for abuse of power. Essentially, the 11th article against Andrew Johnson was for abuse of power. There isn't any question that abuse of power has been used. Now, last point, though, because as a historian, as you can tell, I tend to fall into the bad habit of telling people about a bunch of stuff that happened hundreds of years ago, and they might say, well, who cares? Let's think about the practical implication of Alan Dershowitz's argument. And he himself has sort of baldly admitted this. If you can't impeach an American president for abuse of power, if you need a statutory violation, an actual crime, consider the kinds of things for which you could not remove a president. Lots of examples can be given. Let's take some simple ones first. Let's suppose that tomorrow President Trump wakes up and says, you know, I'm just tired of all this. I don't want to be bothered by all this nonsense. I'm going to Mar-a-Lago for the next 6 months. I'm turning off my phone and my Twitter finger, and I'm not answering phones. I'm just going to, I'm just going to sunbathe. Now, is that a crime? Of course not. Must we be able to impeach him for it? Sure, because he's not doing his job. Or let's take some more serious examples. And this is one that, amazingly, Alan Dershowitz actually includes in this book that he wrote in 30 days, a summer or two ago. Dershowitz posits this, that a Trump American president decides that the Russians really ultimately have a better claim to Alaska than we do. Because after all, if you remember, we got it from them. And assume the American president says, Vladimir, you can have it back. Is that a crime? No, of course not. Does it violate any statute? Not that I know of. Must we be able to impeach a president who's essentially being willing to give away one of the 50 states to a foreign power? Of course we must. Is it because it's an abuse of power? And honest to God, Dershowitz says in his book, he doesn't think that's impeachable. That's the implication of his argument. To take a more serious example, historical argument that was actually made during the Johnson impeachment, the Andrew Johnson impeachment in 1868. The same argument was made, that it has to be a crime. In an article I wrote a couple of days ago, I characterized this contention that impeachable offenses have to be crimes and can't be abuse of power. I characterize that as constitutional crabgrass, because it's a weed that pops up every time you have an impeachment, and the president's defenders always raise the argument. It's always wrong, and you always have to essentially eradicate it. Andrew Johnson's defenders made the same argument. And one of the House managers then, a guy named Ben Butler, who was a really lousy Union general but a pretty good House manager, rises and says, consider the implications of the argument that's being made here. Imagine, he says, that in 1861, when the South was organizing itself to secede and declaring that it was going to leave the Union, that we had as president not Abraham Lincoln, but a man who, for whatever reason, genuine conviction, misconstruction of the Constitution, you know, cowardice, maybe even some corruption, essentially concluded that he either couldn't or wouldn't rally the forces of the United States to save the Union. Butler says, can it truly be suggested that if we had a president who refused to save the Union, that we would simply have to meekly accept the destruction tree because what he was doing wasn't a crime? And of course, the question answers itself. Of course not. If a president proposes to do something like that, then plainly we have to be able to remove him. What's the only vehicle in the Constitution for doing so? It's impeachment. So, I mean, Allen's arguments are completely ahistorical. I can tell you from a scholarly point of view, he stands literally alone.
Yeah. I have not. I've talked to a lot of constitutional scholars. I've heard no one say what he says.
And here's another historical comparison that tells you how alone he is. In the Clinton impeachment, again, there really wasn't much arguing about facts, either in the House or the Senate, to be honest. But over in the House, probably one of the most extensive presentations that occurred was that on one or maybe 2 days, 19 constitutional scholars and historians came in to talk about the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors and whether the constitutional provisions on impeachment really applied to what Bill Clinton had done. There was considerable division among those 19 scholars and historians about whether what he'd done counted or not. Genuine, heated debate. Now, I mean, I know who I agree with on that, but the point is there were plenty of respectable people, serious scholars, knowledgeable people on both sides of the question. Look around you today. You know how many people are on Alan Dershowitz's side? None.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. We are speaking to Frank Bowman, again, professor of law at the University of Missouri, visiting scholar at Georgetown Law School, author of the book High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. Let's go to some of our listeners and get their questions and comments in. We're going to begin with Robert, who is in San Francisco. Good afternoon, Robert. You are on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much for the interesting discussion. My questions are, you know, with the understanding that nothing's going to happen with the Senate impeachment process, and it's, you know, the main decisions for the
are going to be
in the election. What are the opportunities for House committees to continue investigating new developments and new evidence? And then also reciprocally on the Senate side, it seems very odd that none of the committees on the Senate side have actually subpoenaed Hunter Biden despite all the hoopla. And it seems like they could have easily done that, but they haven't.
So. Good question, Robert. Appreciate it. Yeah, Frank Bowman, I've thought of that myself. Like, okay, you know, you control the Senate. There's no reason why you couldn't have done your own investigation into this issue.
Right. And in fact, I think Minority Leader Schumer in the Senate has, and others, also former Senator Claire McCaskill, have made this point repeatedly with respect to Hunter Biden, or indeed anyone else. The thing to understand about the Senate process is that the Chief Justice is essentially a figurehead, and that this proceeding is controlled by anybody who can muster 51 votes. The Republicans have 53, and if they wanted to subpoena Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, President Trump, anybody they wanted to, all they have to do is make a motion to issue such a subpoena and get 51 votes. The fact that they haven't done so as of yet suggests that they're not really all that interested in going down that road. That could prove wrong in the coming days, but we will see. Yeah. But that's something to remember. 51 votes runs this thing,
yeah.
Period. With respect to investigations in the House, of course the House continues to have authority to investigate the executive branch generally and the president particularly. And that authority does not rest entirely on, or by no means entirely, on the impeachment power. Their investigative authority is enhanced when they're engaged in impeachment investigation. But their fundamental investigative power is under the oversight authority that they have. I just did a piece for The Atlantic, I think yesterday or so, that explains why the argument that the Republicans are raising, for example, that the president hasn't obstructed justice because the subpoenas that he was defying hadn't been authorized by the committees, because when the committees issued the subpoenas, there hadn't been a formal vote for impeachment. And the short answer to that is nonsense. It doesn't matter when some vote for impeachment occurs. All the committees who issued subpoenas that produced evidence that we're now looking at were authorized to do so by Rule 10 of the House Standing Rules, to issue subpoenas and compel the production of witnesses and documents in any matter under their jurisdiction.
Yeah, this is something that happens at the beginning of every congressional session, every 2 years. They have the rules that they vote on how the House will operate, and included in those rules is to allow committees, to empower committees to be able to subpoena.
Right. Now, the rule, it turns out that, I mean, and I'm not a great historian of, of congressional rules, but my understanding is that one of the things that happened is that the existing rules were modified actually by the Republicans when they controlled the House to provide sort of standing authority or increased standing authority to a number of committees to go ahead and issue subpoenas without reverting to some special vote of the whole House. But be that as it may, we know that these committees, the committees that conducted the bulk of the factual investigation, plainly had oversight power under Rule 10, or under oversight power under the Constitution, subpoena power under Rule 10. They were issuing subpoenas under that authority. And the fact that at some subsequent point there was a vote to make it an impeachment inquiry doesn't change anything. It's not, the suggestion being made by the president's people is really kind of comical. The idea is that, committees can go along investigating under their regular oversight authority, which they certainly can investigate what's going on in the executive branch. That's a key function of Congress. But the president's position is they can go ahead and do all that until and unless they begin to suspect strongly that perhaps whatever the president's done is impeachable. And then somehow at that point, according to the president's argument, their power to continue the investigation or even to enforce the subpoenas they've already issued goes poof.
Yeah. Unless, no longer counts.
It just doesn't count, yeah. Right? That somehow or other it vanishes like a bubble popping unless and until a resolution is passed. It was just silly.
Yeah.
There's no no warrant for that at all. The larger question, I mean, there's a political question also involved in your listener's question, and that is, you know, can or will or should the House continue to investigate at least matters, say, concerning Ukraine after this trial ends? And, you know, that's going to be a political judgment they have to make. But as a matter of congressional authority, of course they can, simply because, you know, Trump escapes in the Senate doesn't deprive the House of its investigative authority.
Let's try to get through some of these calls, because a lot of these folks have been pretty patient on hold. And right now we're going to go to this very important state of Maine, considering the state of Maine, one of their senators, Susan Collins, who may be very important as to whether or not we're going to have witnesses. And that is Nick. Good afternoon, or I guess for you, good evening, Nick.
Good evening, Mitch. Yeah, you're nationwide. I just wanted to comment really quickly on your discussion with Mr. Nader. He was suggesting that it was possible that with more articles of impeachment, more people might be convinced. And there was a Pew study recently suggesting that upwards of 60% of Republicans in this country get their news exclusively from Fox News. And I know you've been watching Fox lately, so perhaps you know how much of a battering ram would be required to get through and more articles of impeachment on that. But my question is, if the Senate acquits Friday, come Monday morning, there's been so much talk from both sides about what kind of precedent this would set, and the political landscape might look bleak, but my question is, what would the legal landscape look like now that this is an actual piece of jurisprudence for people to look at going forward?
Frank Bowman, can you take that on?
Sorry, could you sort of summarize the question? I'm kind of...
Nick, you still there?
Yeah, I am.
All right. So now, stay there, though, just in case I get it wrong. Nick's basically asking, you know, what happens on Monday if they vote on Friday to acquit Donald Trump? What happens, at least in the field of jurisprudence, the law? What does this affect any, I guess, laws or the way the law applies if Donald Trump is acquitted? Is that right,
no.
Nick?
Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, now people get to point to this as precedent.
As precedent.
And going forward, because both sides keep saying this is going to be precedent, this is going to be precedent. And
that's right.
So,
okay.
Thank you, Nick. The first thing to be said about that is that nothing that happens in any impeachment is really a precedent in the form that lawyers normally think of, in the sense of being binding on some subsequent Congress, because no Congress, House or Senate, can bind its successors. So what we're really talking about when we talk about impeachment, what happens in impeachment in precedents, is that when something happens in an impeachment, it may become kind of a norm. You know, we may draw a lesson from it that will guide future generations, both for good or ill. You know, in Nixon, the lesson that people drew was the Constitution worked, that a president abused his power, the president obstructed justice, the president obstructed Congress, Congress rallied, including members of his own party, investigated, found the truth, compelled him to resign. Good. Different lessons may be drawn from Clinton, and you're seeing, for example, in the behavior of Mr. McConnell, that once one of these things happens, people in later impeachments will point back to what happened in a previous impeachment and say, hey, that's a precedent. We've got to do it that way. And it can be powerful in a persuasive kind of way, but legally it doesn't mean anything. Now, Congress can, next time around, can do whatever it darn well pleases procedurally or in terms of the substance of impeachment. But yeah, it can have influence in what happens in the future.
Next caller is Steven in San Francisco. Steven, good afternoon. You're on the air.
Thanks, Mitch. Professor Bowman, my question relates to your understanding and interpretation of the last paragraph of Article 1, Section 3 of the Constitution, the first portion of which reads as follows. Judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office, comma, and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. Now, I interpret that to permit the Senate to render a judgment that would remove him from office, but still allow Trump to run, if they don't disqualify him, to run for president in 2020. Is that a credible interpretation of that provision?
Well, it's not only credible, I think it's absolutely right, at least under existing Senate practice. There was argument about exactly what a guilty verdict meant in terms of penalty for a long time. I think the universal consensus has always been that conviction automatically equates to removal. There was argument at the beginning that maybe it should also equate to automatically to disqualification. But the current practice since at least the 1920s in the Senate is that the Senate has to take a separate vote. And that's what they do. And in fact, it has saved more saved at least one career in public life. Alcee Hastings, who was a federal district judge in Florida, was acquitted of federal bribery in a criminal prosecution, but was subsequently impeached for essentially that same conduct, impeached and convicted and removed from his federal judgeship by the Senate. But the Senate didn't take the second vote. They didn't vote to disqualify him from future office holding. So former Judge Hastings went back to Miami, and an election cycle or so later, ran for Congress, won, and he's still in Congress today. So your interpretation is right.
Yeah, that's right. He is in Congress today. In fact, he was on the Rules Committee for the House when they were determining the impeachment articles. Let's go to our next caller, who is John in Fresno. Good afternoon, John. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the professor. His explanations are nice and clear and simple.
Good. Yeah, I like him too.
And what will be the Senate vote be to acquit, or will the Senate vote be to convict? And if it doesn't pass, it's an automatic acquittal.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, do you vote to convict, or and if it fails, then you're automatically acquitted?
Well, I guess the answer is yes. I mean, essentially, the question put to the Senate will be, you know, shall Donald John Trump be found, you know, guilty? I don't know how they'll phrase it, guilty or not guilty, of, you know, Article One, and the senators will say either guilty or not guilty. And, you know, you need 60. If you get 67 guilties, then he's found guilty and he's automatically expelled from the presidency. If you get even one fewer than that, he's found not guilty. Now, that is the word acquittal. I mean, technically, that's right. He's acquitted in the sense he's not found guilty. One might ask, you know, does that mean he's exonerated in the sense that he will certainly claim he is, in the sense of that this is a declaration that, you know, he is free of all blame, moral or otherwise, and that the whole affair was merely a partisan witch hunt? Well, no. But certainly that's the construction that he's going to try to place on it. And indeed, I think a side note in all of this is people may wonder why the heck has this process been so incredibly rushed? Part of it, of course, is that the Republicans want it over quickly for lots of reasons, and the longer it goes on, the more possibility there is for things arising like Bolton. But there's another calendar-based reason, which is it's pretty clear that Senator McConnell has wanted this thing to be over and have the president acquitted precisely in time for him to be able to go give the State of Union address and come striding down the center aisle of the House of Representatives and declare himself exonerated and to declare his accusers the next thing to traitors. That, I think, is the objective here from a political perspective from Mr. Trump's administration. And frankly, at the rate things are going, it's not unlikely that that's exactly what we'll have.
Next caller is Avery in Antioch. This is the city I was born in, Avery. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mitch. To dovetail on what you're talking about, yes, there seemed to be this thrust by the House managers that you know, you don't want to acquit him before you see Bolton's book. That would seem to imply that double jeopardy restrictions apply to impeachment, but is there anything that says they do? If Bolton's book comes out and it does have more damning material against Trump, then does anything stop Adam Schiff from marching the House managers back over to the Senate and, in the vein of David Lee Roth, saying, I heard you missed me, I'm back?
Thank you for that, Avery.
Well, the technical answer is yes. The House of Representatives can impeach a president or, frankly, any other civil officer under the Constitution every day and twice on Sunday if they want. I think the political answer is that if impeachment fails here, it is profoundly unlikely that it will be resurrected in the remainder, certainly, of Mr. Trump's first term. Certainly, I think there's, you know, no to zero chance that they would try to impeach him again for the Ukraine affair. And, you know, double jeopardy does not apply. This is not a criminal proceeding. Double jeopardy only applies in criminal cases. So, yeah, they could do it. Politically, are they likely to? No.
Frank Bowman, I have a burning question for you. I need to make sure I get it to you because it piqued my interest during today's sessions and questions and responses to the questions from Trump's defense team. And that is this idea, going back to the House has the sole power of impeachment. And they were making the argument that is giving it its awesome power, that all you need then is basically for a proclamation of, you know, the Speaker of the House to say this is now an impeachment inquiry, and then suddenly there's no checks on that power, that the House can suddenly subpoena whoever they like for whatever reason, because in impeachment the House just has the sole authority and no one has any other rights outside of the House's ability to conduct an impeachment inquiry.
Well, I'm not sure exactly, frankly, what the president's lawyers are trying to suggest there. I guess the idea somehow is that because the congressional power of investigation and compulsion is enhanced when they are exercising their impeachment power.
And I think is the idea that you actually, no, we don't have to go to the courts to try to compel your testimony because this is our sole power. Courts have nothing to do with this.
Let's put it this way. My position has always been that impeachment is simply one of the many powers that Article I grants Congress. And that you don't need some special resolution of for the House to exercise that power any more than you need a special resolution for the power to, you know, to inquire into matters relating to appropriations or building a post office. That impeachment is simply one of the many powers Congress exercises, and incident to all of those powers is a power to inquire, to determine, whether facts exist on which we ought to either legislate or impeach. Now, I think the only time at which this argument that they're trying to make might make some sense is if you're actually electing to litigate this question of, if the House decides it wants to go to the courts to try to enforce subpoenas, I think courts are going to recognize that if the House declares, as declared in some, that is in fact proceeding under an impeachment, the courts are going to give those demands even more force than they would to ordinary or oversight powers. But this sort of parade of horribles, slippery slope kind of argument that the president's lawyers are making, is just not very convincing because, as I say, I think that the impeachment power is implicit all the time. And more to the point, understand here that what the president did with respect to obstruction is, as Adam Schiff and others argue today, it isn't that he, as some presidents have done in the past, selectively objected to testimony by this witness on grounds of executive privilege or production of this set of documents because they're particularly sensitive or whatever. Past presidents have made those kinds of objections, and they've been dealt with either by some sort of a negotiation or occasionally by going to court. That's not what Trump did. He sent a letter through his counsel, and I think it was October the 8th or so, and said, we're not going to comply with anything.
Anything.
Now, and not just the White House, but every federal employee, all 2 million federal employees, and all the agencies to whom subpoenas were directed were ordered not to comply, not to produce a single document. And as the House managers have said over and over again, they haven't. Not one single document.
Frank Bowman. Fully unprecedented and I think significant. Frank Bowman has been our guest, professor of law at the University of Missouri, visiting scholar at Georgetown Law School, and author of the book High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. Frank Bowman, I know you're very much in demand now from a lot of people. So we are incredibly thankful to you for spending an hour with us today. Thank you.
Mitch, it's a great pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure was ours.